Our theme text for this hour is taken from Leviticus 25:10. You've no doubt read it many times over the years. And ye shall hallow the 50th year and proclaim liberty throughout all the land unto all the inhabitants thereof. It shall be a jubilee unto you, and ye shall return every man unto his possession, and ye shall return every man unto his family. What does jubilee mean? If you boil it down, what does it really mean? Well, it comes from the Hebrew word yobel, and it means a blast of a horn. But specifically, it means the signal of the silver trumpets. Who had the silver trumpets? Did everyone throughout the land of Israel have a silver trumpet? And who blew these trumpets? We're given the answer to these questions in Numbers chapter 10, verses 2, 8, and 10. Numbers 10, 2, 8, and 10. And those read, in part, make thee two trumpets of silver, and the sons of Aaron the priest shall blow with the trumpets. Also in the day of your gladness ye shall blow with the trumpets. The day of gladness. The day of gladness, we believe, is the first day of Jubilee. It is also the day of atonement. It was the priests of Israel who blew the trumpets. It was the priests who announced the beginning of the Jubilee. But the priests weren't the only ones blowing horns. Leviticus chapter 25, verse 9. Then shalt thou cause trumpet to sound throughout all your land. Well, the trumpet here is not a silver trumpet. No, this trumpet is a completely different kind of trumpet. This trumpet is a shofar. And you've undoubtedly seen images of the shofar, the curved mountain goat horn or ram's horn that was used to make sound. It's a cartilage horn. Who blew these? Well, the priests did not blow the shofars. No, it was the common people. It was the people throughout the land that blew the shofars. So the priests are the ones that blew the silver trumpets. They announced the beginning. But the priest did not go around personally parading throughout the entire land, blowing the silver trumpets. No, that's not how the word got out. But rather, it was the people. The people heard the silver trumpets, and then they responded by blowing their horns, the shofars, the ram's horns. And so there was this chain reaction throughout all the land. They didn't have email back then. Thus, there was two different kinds of horns. Not just one, but two different kinds of horns that were used to proclaim the Jubilee. What's the basic concept of Israel's Jubilee? When you boil it down, what does it really boil down to? Well, it boils down to one word that we read in Leviticus 25:10. It all boils down to the one word, return. That's the word, the Hebrew word, shub, S-H-U-B. It means to restore. Restore from what? We know every 50 years the Israelites got themselves out of balance. They got themselves out of balance economically. They've got themselves out of balance socially. And during the Jubilee, the Israelites were to return to their former estate. Return to their former liberties. Return to their former possessions. Every 50 years, the Israelites' freedoms were restored. Now, here we are, we're many years later, and we're still talking about this ancient event called the Jubilee. Why is it important in the year 2012? Is it important? Should we be talking about it? Paul answers this in Hebrews chapter 10, verse 1. Hebrews 10, 1, where he says, for the law having a shadow of good things to come. So the Jubilee, we know, was part of natural Israel's law. It pictured the good things to come, Paul says. It meant more than just back then. It meant more than just the things that Israel did. It pictured the good things to come. But note what Paul says specifically about Israel's Sabbath days. In Hebrews 10:1, he says, the law was a shadow of good things to come. But in Colossians chapter 2, verses 16 and 17, he says that the Sabbath days are a shadow of things to come. So Paul here, point blank, gives us the thought that Israel's Sabbath days picture the good things to come. Now, how many different kinds of jubilees or restitutions does the Bible speak of? Now, the question is not how many times Israel celebrated a jubilee. The question is how many different kinds of jubilees or restitutions does the Bible speak of? Is there one? Is there 10? Is there 100? We believe the answer is 2. The Bible speaks of 2. The first one the Bible speaks of is what we will characterize, what we will label as Moses' restitution. Leviticus chapter 25. And this restitution was limited to one tiny nation on earth, and it was only for a temporary period of time. Remember, it had to keep repeating every 50 years. But there's another kind that the Bible speaks of, and we're calling that one Peter's restitution. Acts chapter 3, verses 19 to 21. No doubt you can all quote it by heart. You've read it many times. But this is different. This is bigger because it's the restitution, Peter says, of all things. And it's permanent. It's not temporary. Peter's restitution, much broader than Moses. It's global and it's permanent. Jesus suggests to us that there is a connection between these two jubilees, these two restitutions. And he gives us this thought in Matthew chapter 5, verse 18. Matthew 5, 18. There Jesus says, till heaven and earth pass, one jot or one tittle shall in no wise pass from the law till all be fulfilled. Israel's law is a small-scale model, as it were, a small-scale model of what the world will experience. So what Jesus is teaching us here is that Moses' restitution pictures Peter's restitution. If you want to know more about Peter's global permanent restitution, study more about Israel's local temporary restitution. In Acts chapter 3, Peter adds to what Jesus taught in Matthew chapter 5, 18. He adds another dimension to it. He says, beginning at the times of restitution will be the time of the Lord's second advent. He says in verse 21 that the heavens must retain Jesus until the times of restitution of all things. When the times of global restitution starts, Jesus must be personally present. He must have returned. Why? Why are these two events associated? Why do we associate, or why does Peter associate, the beginning of the times of restitution and Jesus' return? Because there's obviously a connection between the two. God sends Jesus to take charge of the global restitution work. Now, how does Moses' restitution picture Peter's restitution? We suggest that it pictures it in two different ways. Moses' restitution pictures what will happen in Peter's restitution. And Moses' restitution pictures when Peter's restitution will begin, when it will happen. We're going to take a look at both of these aspects. Let's first take a look at the what. How does Moses' restitution picture what will happen in Peter's? We suggest there are at least 5 ways. We're going to suggest 5 today, but we're going to say there's at least 5. Moses' restitution was 5-dimensional. Restitution is not a single-dimensional topic or subject. It's at least 5-dimensional. Let's look at each of the 5. In Moses' restitution, the first dimension we see, we would say, debts canceled. debt's canceled. This is implied in Leviticus chapter 25, verses 39 to 41. And there we read in part, "If thy brother be waxen poor and be sold unto thee, thou shalt not compel him to serve as a bondservant, but as an hired servant. He shall serve thee unto the year of Jubilee, and then shall he depart from thee." You know, we've heard a lot in this day and age about financial difficulties of people in the world. And, you know, the ancient Israelites were really kind of like the people of today. Some of them fell deeply into debt. You know, debt is another form of bondage, isn't it? You can become a slave to your debts. And that's what happened to Israel. And often these debts, this deep debt, was incurred through no fault of their own. Sometimes it was a result of health issues or maybe aging or whatnot. But the Jubilee provided debt relief. Today we call it bankruptcy laws. Debt relief. Debts were legally canceled, and freedom, freedom from this debt bondage was given, was provided. What about in Peter's Jubilee? Well, in Peter's Jubilee, we see that through no fault of their own, the world has gotten themselves into a debt that they can never repay. We're told of this in Psalms chapter 51, verse 5. Psalms 51, 5. "In sin did my mother conceive me." Adam's children did not choose to be born in sin, did they? They were born into it through no choice of their own. They inherited it. And Paul talks about this in Romans chapter 5, verse 12, when he said, "One man sinned and death passed upon all men, for that all have sinned." Now, Jesus alludes to this unpayable debt, this debt that the human race could never pay, in his parable of the unforgiving steward that we find in Matthew 18, 24. But you know, Peter's Jubilee fixes this problem. Jesus pays the world's sin debt with his own life, and Adam and all of his children thereupon become legally debt-free. Let's look at a second dimension of Moses' restitution. We're going to call this one possessions restored. Possessions restored. And we're talking here about the land, and perhaps it also included items of personal property. We find this alluded to in Leviticus 25, verse 13. And there we read, "In the year of Jubilee, ye shall return every man unto his possession." Now, one way a person could legally satisfy his debts was to liquidate whatever he had, liquidate his property. But this sale was really only, and we're going to be technical here, this sale was really not a sale. It was really an assignment of a lease. Now, if we look back in Leviticus chapter 25, verse 23, we see that God prohibited Israel from doing what we would call today an absolute sale of their property. God said, "I own the property. I'm going to lease it to you. You're only a tenant. You're only a lessee." And so, by the Israelites transferring their property to liquidate their property to satisfy their debt, they were really only taking the lease that they had, and they were assigning that lease to someone else as the liquidation process. Moses' Jubilee ended this assignment. Moses' Jubilee terminated the lease assignment, and the land was returned to the original lessee. If you prefer to think of this in terms of ownership, that's okay, but technically it was not ownership. The Israelites did not own the land. They only leased it. What about in Peter's Jubilee? Well, when Adam was created, he was endowed with wonderful possessions. And we read of this in Psalms, the 8th chapter, verses 4 through 6, which we read in part. What is man? Thou hast made him a little lower than the angels, and hast crowned him with glory and honor, and madest him to have dominion over the works of thy hands. When Adam was created, he was made in God's mental image. He was given the ability to reason. He was given the ability to think. He was given the wonderful ability to create. Look how creative some of the people are in our day. They were created in God's image, and that was part of the programming, as it were. But they were also made in God's moral image. When man was created, the law of love was inscribed into his heart. And he was given dominion over the earth. He was given dominion not over other people, but over the fish and over the fowl and over every living thing on the earth. He was given a beautiful home in Eden. And we know that the Garden of Eden was really perfect in every way, and it represented a perfect earth. But sin entered. Adam disobeyed. And these possessions were lost to one degree or another. Man became essentially insane. Became selfish. He lost control of the earth. He was evicted from the garden. But Peter's Jubilee witnesses the return of all these lost possessions. For this text, we looked in Psalms chapter 90, verse 3. Psalms chapter 90, verse 3. Which says in part, "Return, ye children of men." Return. Return to a sane mind. Return to the mental image of God. Return to the moral image of God. Return to a love-filled heart. Return to kingship of earth. Return to paradise. Return to a perfect earthly home. Return, return, return. Let's look at a third dimension of Moses' restitution. We're going to call this one personal liberty restored. Now, we've already looked at the text that supports this, which is in Leviticus 25, verses 39 to 41. But there, just to paraphrase, if one fails through mismanagement, whatever, he falls into debt, must sell his personal liberty, sell his property and perhaps his personal liberty, and become a servant, the law required that he be set free in the year of Jubilee. And some became so deeply indebted that they had to sell themselves into servitude. They were forced to sell their own liberty to subsist. They became slaves. Not slaves in the sense that we normally think of that, because the scripture is very clear that they were to be treated not as slaves, but as hired servants. But it was still a form of bondage. Moses' Jubilee ended the bondage. The servitude was done. The personal freedom was restored. What about Peter's Jubilee? Well, man has been in the prison house of death for over 6,000 years. He's been enslaved by every conceivable form of sin that you can think of, and probably more. Disease, substance abuse, crime, friends, the list goes on. And try as he would, man has been helpless to extricate himself from this prison house of sin and death that he's been in for a long time. But Peter's Jubilee changes that. The slaves will indeed be liberated from the prison. How our hearts sing and rejoice when we meditate upon Isaiah chapter 61, verse 1, which we read in part, "The Lord hath anointed me to preach the good tidings, to proclaim liberty to the captives and the opening of the prison to them that are bound." What a wonderful prospect. No more sin. No more evil, no more sickness or death or tyranny or ignorance. What a grand and glorious prospect. The Christ, the true freedom fighters, the great liberators, will take charge. Paul alludes to this in 1 Corinthians 15, verses 25 and 26, when he says, "For he, that is to say, the Christ, head and body glorified, must reign till he hath put all enemies under his feet, and the last enemy that shall be destroyed is Adamic death." Let's look at a fourth dimension of Moses' restitution. We're going to call this one Families Reunited. Families Reunited. This is given to us in Leviticus chapter 25, verse 10. And there we read in part, "Ye shall return every man unto his family." Well, in ancient Israel, indebtedness and servitude often led to the split up of the Israelite families. Families were scattered as bankrupt Israelites went wherever they had to go, or wherever they could go, to survive. And the separation sometimes lasted for long periods, lasted for decades. But Moses' Jubilee ended this separation. It ended the estrangement that had occurred. Imagine the joy, friends. Imagine the joy when one of your relatives, your long-lost and separated relatives, returned home. Can you imagine the family reunion of family reunions that took place? What joy had to abound. What about Peter's Jubilee? Well, over the past 6,000 years, Adam's family has become deeply estranged. And this estrangement has occurred on a couple of different levels. First of all, violence, hatred, deceit, inhumanity, fraud, mistreatment, the list goes on. The human race has become totally dysfunctional. Separation from each other, that's what we call horizontal separation or estrangement. And there's been vertical estrangement, separation from God. Peter's Jubilee changes all that. Friends, we're going to see the reunion of reunions. And Paul promises that in Ephesians chapter 1, verse 10, when he says that in the dispensation of the fullness of times, he might gather together in one all things in Christ, both which are in heaven and which are on earth, even in him. A global reunion on every level. Man with man with God. The animal kingdom will be reconciled. The angelic, man with earth. In every way, there'll be a reconciliation and a harmony that will be reestablished. Let's look at a fifth dimension of Moses' Jubilee. Leviticus 25, verse 11. We're going to call this one, "The Land Rested." Leviticus 25, 11. "Ye shall not sow, neither reap that which groweth of itself." Ancient Israel's Jubilee was a year of rest for the land. No sowing, no cultivating, no systematic harvesting. They were allowed to pick and eat whatever grew spontaneously on the land, but there was no systematic harvesting. Now we know that letting land lie fallow for a period of time is good land management, isn't it? We still do that today in our farming communities. Allowing the soil to lie fallow replenishes the soil with nitrogen and other important nutrients. So it's important for the land, to give the land a break. Let's consider what has happened to the earth, friends, on a global scale in the past 6,000 years. After Adam sinned, we know that God cursed the earth for man's sake, for man's benefit, as we read in Genesis chapter 3, verse 17. The perfecting process that had been started in Eden was brought to a halt. But worse than that, man began to heap gross abuses upon his environment, upon his home, the earth. Pollution, natural resource mismanagement, scarred earth, dust bowls, air pollution, water pollution. Again, the list goes on. Land abuse has been for man's benefit as part of the permission of evil, is what we're being taught in Genesis 3, 17. But Peter's restitution changes all that. In Isaiah chapter 35, verses 6 and 7, we read in part that the waters break out, and the parched ground shall become a pool. Later on in Isaiah chapter 60, verse 13, "I will make the place of my feet, God's feet, the earth, the place of his feet, glorious. The abuses that have been heaped upon the earth will be stopped, the effects will be reversed, and the Edenic conditions will prevail everywhere in God's due time. So Moses' jubilee of rest for the land pictures the perfecting of the entire earth. But is that all there is? Is that all there was to the land rest component in Moses' day? We believe that there's something more. There's something bigger that came out of the land rest than just rest for the land, as important as that was. The benefits of land rest in both Moses' jubilee and Peter's jubilee go beyond, far beyond, just restoring the soil. Let's consider what happened back in Moses' day. Israel was an agrarian society, largely. It was a farming society. That's how they subsisted. Now, when God said, no sowing, no cultivating, no systematic harvesting, what did he do to their economy? God just put them out of business. He just put them out of business, out of work, for 2 consecutive years. Because remember, the 49th year was a Sabbath year. And the 50th year was a Sabbath year. 2 consecutive years of rest for the land. And the Israelites couldn't work. God said, don't worry. Trust me. I'll take care of you. Leviticus chapter 25, 21 gives us this indication of where God said, I will take care of you. He says, then I will command my blessing upon you in the 6th year, and it shall bring forth fruit for 3 years. Now, if we apply this text and we think of the 50-year Jubilee cycle, we are talking here about the 48th, the 49th, the 50th years of the 50-year cycle, and the 1st year of the following cycle. The 48th year harvest will carry you through the 49th year, the 50th year, and on into the 1st year until you harvest your crops during that 1st year of the next 50-year cycle. Now, you can live off the land. You can pick whatever grows of itself to the extent that you need it. Now, how should we interpret this 3-year promise in Leviticus 25, 21? Well, there's at least 2 ways that we can interpret this promise or view this promise that he would give them fruit. He would give them provision for 3 years. One way we can look at this is that the 48th year provided 3 times greater crop than they had had in any previous year. So in other words, one way to look at this is that if the normal yield was, let's say, 50 bushels of grain per acre per year in a normal harvesting year. One way you can look at this text is that during this 48th year, it would be 150 bushels of grain per acre that year. 3 times more to get them through the length of period of time that they were not allowed to farm. That's one way we can look at this text. But there's a second suggestion. The people had to live frugally. They had to conserve. They had to live on less. They consumed less. Less focus on the earthly. And what would that allow time for? More focus on the spiritual. They would have to do a degree of fasting. Consuming less. And fasting stimulated and restored their faith and trust in God. Exodus 31, 13. If this second suggestion is correct, this 2-year land rest restored their spiritual relationship with God. More time for study, more time for worship, and more time for meditation and appreciation. Numbers chapter 28, verse 9. Now, giving the land a year off was not rare. It was quite common, as we mentioned just a moment ago. Remember, every seventh year was a sabbatical year for the land. Every 7 years. So giving the year a land off, giving the land a year off was not all that uncommon. But the Jubilee, the Sabbath, was different because it was two consecutive Sabbath years. And by declaring the Jubilee year a land Sabbath, we believe that God had more in mind than just giving the land a year off. He had in mind to restore Israel's faith. He had in mind to restore Israel's trust and their confidence in God as their father and as their caretaker. What we're suggesting, friends, is that Moses' Jubilee year restored the Israelites spiritually. It restored their soul, and it restored their soil. What about the global situation? What about if we look at Peter's restitution? Well, Adam had great respect for God. He looked up to him in all ways. He was obedient before the fall. But since the fall, the world has since lost much of its personal veneration, its personal respect for God. Remember when Jesus said in Leviticus chapter 18, verse 8, "When the Son of Man cometh, shall he find faith on the earth?" And this was certainly true at the first advent and certainly true at the second advent. Minimal, or in some cases, no veneration for God, we believe, is the world's greatest loss, and Peter's restitution is going to fix it. Psalms chapter 46, verse 10, "Be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the heathen. I will be exalted in the earth." Peter's Jubilee is going to restore mankind spiritually. Peter's Jubilee will re-enthrone God in the hearts of men. This, we suggest, is the greatest dimension of the world's restitution, and it's pictured in the land rest. Now let's look for a moment, to the wind question. Now, I apologize, this might be a little technical for the next few minutes, but there's some points here that we think we'd like to highlight. How does Moses' restitution picture when Peter's restitution will happen? We're looking at the when question now. Well, in ancient Israel, in their culture, God set up two basic kinds of Sabbaths. He set up the lesser Sabbath, and he set up the greater Sabbath. The lesser Sabbath pictures what happens in the greater, just as we've looked at. But also the lesser Sabbath must be used to determine when the greater Sabbath begins. Let's look at two examples of this interplay between lesser and greater Sabbaths. We look at the comparison of the Sabbath day and the Jubilee day. Sabbath day, Jubilee day. In Exodus 31:15, we read that the seventh day of every week is a Sabbath of rest, no work. So every seventh day of the week was a Sabbath day, as we already know. In Leviticus 23, verses 15 and 16, we're told there that the seventh day multiplied by 7 weeks or cycles gives you 49. 7 times 7 is 49. And then the following was the day of Pentecost. So here God is showing us something. He said, square the lesser Sabbath, the every seventh day, by itself, to determine the date of the greater Sabbath. All right, fairly simple, fairly straightforward. The day of Pentecost was a day of special blessing and worship and rest. Let's look at a second example of a lesser and a greater Sabbath. The Sabbath year and the Jubilee year. Leviticus 25, verses 1 to 4, we learned that every seventh year from the time that Israel set forth in the land was a Sabbath year. In Leviticus 25, verses 8 to 10, we find that this seventh year, multiplied by seven cycles, gives us 49 years, and the following one was the Jubilee year. Again, very straightforward. But here we see, in both of these examples, and God gave us not just one witness here, He gave us two. God has established here a time pattern. And the pattern is very simple. You square the lesser Sabbath to determine when the greater Sabbath begins. Friends, this is not something that we create out of the abundance of our imagination. We simply have to read the association between the Sabbath day and Jubilee day and the Sabbath year and the Jubilee year. And relative to Peter's Jubilee, Moses' Jubilee, we suggest, is the lesser Sabbath. Moses' Jubilee is the lesser Sabbath. Peter's Jubilee is the greater Sabbath. It's a 50-year cycle, Moses. By squaring Moses' lesser Sabbath of 50 years, that gives us Peter's grand cycle of 2,500. So 2,500 years is the measuring stick. It's the one that God gives us. And it gets us from Moses' Jubilee to Peter's Jubilee. The only question is, from what point do we start measuring the 2,500? Jesus gives us, once again, the answer in Matthew chapter 5, verse 18. Applying Jesus' law that He gives us in Matthew 5:18, we find that when the type, that is to say Moses' restitution, ceases, the antitype begins. Israel set forth in the land, they set forth foot in the land in October 1576 B.C. So we simply add 19 Jubilee cycles plus 19 years later, and they were carried off to Babylon for 70 years. Now 70 is greater than 50, isn't it? So this means that when they were carried off to Babylon, they stopped celebrating Jubilees. The cycle was broken when they were taken to Babylon. No more Jubilees. So Moses' Jubilee system ceased at the end of the 19th Jubilee cycle, which was in October 626, as we know from our chronology studies. So if we simply measure 2500 from 626 BC, it gives you October 1875 AD. Uh-oh. Problem? No. We're reaching here for the antitype. We're reaching here for the fulfillment. The 2,500th year, as we learn in Volume 2, is part of the antitype of 1,000 years. The 2,500th year was a Jubilee year. The 1,000-year antitypical Jubilee replaces it. So Peter's 1,000-year times of restitution begin in October 1874. Now God has given us a second witness, a prophetic witness to prove October 1874. God desolated the land for 70 consecutive years, beginning at the end of Zedekiah's reign in 606. Why? He tells us in 2 Chronicles chapter 36, verse 21. 2 Chronicles 36, 21. To fulfill 70 Jubilee or chief Sabbath years perfectly. God designed that 70 of Moses' Jubilee cycles would measure the time between the time that Israel entered the land and the time of the beginning of Peter's Jubilee. The length of time from entering the land to Peter's Jubilee is 3,449 years. It's 3,449 and not 3,500 because the first 19 Jubilees were 50 years each. The remaining 51 were 49 years each because none of those 51 were actually celebrated. Again, the concept here is very straightforward. So if we add 3449 to October 1576 BC, we reach October 1874. 70 cycles from the time that Israel entered the land until we reach the beginning of Peter's Jubilee. That's the fundamentals. And all that we've said so far, undoubtedly you've gleaned from Volume 2, which is where we were privileged to get our information. But now we want to do something that perhaps we have not done before. We want to consider a supposed objection. Since October 1874, an estimated 100 million people have died and been killed in an attempt to socialize the world. An estimated 60 to 80 million people, military and civilian, were killed in World War II. Over 6 million Jews were slaughtered in the Holocaust. Scientists estimate that over 150,000 people die every day on this globe. That's over 50 million people a year are dying around the globe. Since October 1874, the world has continued to be plagued with disease and sickness and starvation. Since October 1874, we've seen the emergence of terrorism and counterterrorism. We've seen rampant and stubborn world poverty and illiteracy. Most of the people on this earth today are living on less than $1 a day. Abject poverty. Illiteracy. We've seen the emergence of obesity, and now we're dealing with alarming childhood obesity. We've seen all kinds of environmental crises, water shortages, pollution, erosion, and the list goes on. We've seen criminal activity continue at practically what seems to be an unabated rate. Murders, drug abuses, the list goes on. In short, friends, since October 1874, evil has abounded in this world. Let's not sugarcoat it and say it's not there. It's there. Doesn't the prevalence of evil in the world soundly negate all that we've just said? Doesn't it soundly negate the suggestion that we are in the times of restitution? We answer no. The prevalence of evil in the world does not negate the beginning of the times of restitution. And we suggest the following. The text in 2 Peter chapter 1, verse 19, doesn't directly apply to this subject, but there's a principle here. There's a concept and a principle that we'd like to talk to you about that we believe in our minds, in our hearts, provides at least a portion of the answer of how we can reconcile all the evil in the world with being in the times of restitution. 2 Peter chapter 1, verse 19. We have also a more sure word of prophecy, whereunto ye do well that ye take heed, as unto a light that shineth in a dark place, until the day dawn and the day star arise in your hearts. Now in this text, Peter is reflecting on his Mount of Transfiguration experience. Remember when the Lord took him in vision up to the Mount of Transfiguration? And Peter is saying here, I firmly believe that God will establish his kingdom on earth. I believe it because I saw it. Not literally. He saw it in a vision. He saw it in the mind's eye. I saw the glorified Christ. I saw the glorified church. I saw the ancient worthies. I saw the kingdom. It's real. And my vision of the kingdom was as clear and bright as the noonday sun on a cloudless day. But there's something that eclipses my vision, Peter says. Something more sure. The most convincing thing here about the certainty of the kingdom is the sure word of prophecy. The most convincing thing is the Bible. The most convincing thing is the revealed word of God. The more sure word of prophecy transcends any observations. The more sure word of prophecy transcends any preconceived notions that we may have about Peter's restitution. You know, the more sure word of prophecy for us, friends, boils down to two main texts. Two witnesses. And we've already mentioned them. In Matthew 5:18, Jesus declared God's law that when the type ends, when the type stops, the antitype starts. It's that simple. Matthew 5:18 in our minds is that simple. When the type stops, the antitype starts. Israel stopped celebrating Jubilees in 626 BC, and something critical happened there. Jesus assures us that the antitype then and there began, and one grand cycle later, October 1874. God, through Moses, gave us this second witness in 2 Chronicles 36:21, that there would be 70 jubilee cycles extending between the time that Israel entered their land and the times of restitution. We know that Israel entered their land in 1576 B.C. You add 70 cycles to that, October 1874. Friends, any preconceived notions we have about the times of restitution must yield to what the Bible teaches. It doesn't matter about our preconceived notions. No matter how dark and how evil the world may look, that does not negate the Bible. The Bible represents the only point of view that matters. And what's the only point of view that matters? It's God's point of view. Paul said in Romans chapter 3, verse 4, "Let God be true, though it should prove every man a liar." Our preconceived notions don't count. Let's consider a second reason why evil in the world does not negate the times of restitution beginning in 1874. The brethren alluded to Matthew 24 yesterday. Now, our ecclesia spent over 2 years studying Matthew 24. We're not going to give it 2 minutes. Not because it's not worth 2 years, but we don't have 2 years. Matthew chapter 24, verse 45. You can all quote it undoubtedly from memory. "Who then is a faithful and wise servant whom the Lord hath made ruler over his household to give them meat in due season?" Let's talk about Matthew 24. What's the big picture of Matthew 24? We call it the Lord's great prophecy. Matthew 24, the entire chapter, is Jesus' answer to a relatively simple question that the disciples asked. And the simple question, in our own words, is, "Lord, Lord, how will we know when you have returned?" How are we going to? We don't want to miss it. We don't want to miss it. So, how will we know when you have returned? What's Jesus' reply to this relatively short question? Well, Jesus gives them a very long answer to a very short question. Why? Because it was going to be a long time between the time he was speaking to them then, First Advent, and the time of the Second Advent. Notice what Jesus touches on as we go through this entire chapter. Jesus touches on world history. He touches on wars. He touches on church history. He touches on persecution. He touches on the restoration and the revival of the nation of Israel. He touches on the call of the new creation. He touches on the gospel harvest and many other things. We call it the Lord's great prophecy because Jesus gave his disciples 2,000 years of history in advance. It wasn't 2,000 years of history past, it was 2,000 years of history in advance. But you know, one of the most interesting parts of Jesus' discourse is in verses 42 and 44. Matthew 24, verse 42. He says, "Watch therefore, for ye know not what hour your Lord doth come. Therefore, be ye also ready. For in such an hour as ye think not, the Son of Man cometh." Friends, capture the significance of these two verses. Jesus just gave them 2,000 years of history. He gave them all these benchmarks to look for that would happen over this long period of time. And then look what he says toward the end of his discourse. "You know all these things that I gave you? You're still not going to know. All these events aren't going to tell you what moment I arrive. You're still not going to know." And then we read verse 45. "Who then is that faithful and wise servant?" What's Jesus saying in verses 42 and 44? He's saying, be alert, be prepared, because you're not going to know the specific date and time of my arrival from this advance, all this advance history I've told you. You're not going to know. But let me tell you how you will know when I return. Quite simply, I have a servant. I will have my servant, my special servant, tell you. I will supply him with all my goods. I will supply him with all essential truth that you will need. Part of the essential truth I will give him will be the Jubilee Law and the Jubilee Prophecy. I will explain both of these to him. That's how he'll know when I've returned. That's what he'll use to tell you when I've returned. And that's how you will know. In fact, that is the only way you will know. I will have my servant tell you, because I'm going to explain it to him, and he will in turn explain it to you. You know, the faith, why are we bringing this up? I know I'm preaching to the choir here on the faithful and wise servant, but there's a point here. The faithful and wise servant lived in the midst of global trouble. The faithful and wise servant lived in the midst of chaos, of war, of conflict, of evil of all kinds. Friends, we only have to peruse volume 4 to get some sense of the kind of condition that the world was in the late 1800s and early 1900s. The world was bad then. We think it's bad today. It was also bad then. But yet, this did not dissuade the Lord's servant from declaring the beginning of the times of restitution in his day. When World War I broke out in 1914, the faithful and wise servant did not retract the truth that he had published in 1889 in Volume 2, that the times of restitution began in October 1874. He didn't say, wow, this is really bad. This World War, I must have made a mistake. No, he didn't retract it. In fact, just the opposite. This is ironic. Instead of concluding that the World War actually militated against the sure word of prophecy, he actually declared that the terrible time of trouble was a sign that the times of restitution had begun. It was a corroborative evidence. And we cite you to Oberlin Monthly, pages 84 to 88. Well, there's more. There's always more. The half still has not been told. But I believe my time is up, right, Brother Chairman? Okay. Well, we wanted to offer one final line of thought for consideration. The times of restitution is not single-dimensional. It's not an all-or-nothing thing. It has at least 5 dimensions. But all 5 dimensions don't necessarily begin at the same time. That's why we wanted to emphasize this 5-dimensional concept. The times restitution, the word times comes from chronos. Chronos, like chronology, chronometer. And it means a sequence of events. That's the best definition of time. Time is a sequence of events. Some of the dimensions of restitution have clearly not begun. Man's sin debt has not yet been paid. He's still on death row. Man's personal liberty is not yet restored. He's still locked up in the prison house of death. Man's heart is still selfish. He's not yet reformed, because the new law covenant that's going to give him his new heart is not yet inaugurated. So where has restitution been beginning since October 1874? How do we understand God's point of view on the times of restitution? The answer is in Leviticus 23, verse 3, for this speaker. 6 days shalt thou work be done, but the 7th day is the Sabbath of rest, a holy convocation. Ye shall do no work therein. It is the Sabbath of the Lord. Friends, it doesn't matter which one of God's Sabbaths we consider. Every one of God's Sabbaths, both typical and antitypical, have 2 common threads. cessation of the normal activity and engaging in holy convocation with God. So what God is saying is, stop what you're doing, wake up, and get your thinking back in line with my thinking. That's the whole idea of restitution. This describes, we believe, at least in part, what's been happening gradually on a cultural level since October 1874. This is being done through the increase of knowledge, through the sounding of the Jubilee trump of knowledge and liberty being spread and broadcast throughout the land. You know, as a culture, generally speaking, not always, but generally, we no longer approve the use of racial epithets. God doesn't approve the use of racial epithets. And now, generally speaking, we don't either. As a global culture, we generally insist on gradually eliminating environmental pollution. You know, God's not in favor of pollution either, is he? In about a week and a half from now, we have Earth Summit 2012 occurring in Rio de Janeiro in Brazil. Now, you can poo-poo this idea, but our point here is that over 190 nations, almost every nation on Earth, is going to participate in some level in Earth Summit 2012. Friends, restitution, this concern for our Earth, our environment, is no longer just a United States perspective. Almost every nation on this Earth is now concerned about the environment. Friends, I'm not saying they're going to fix it in Rio de Janeiro next week. I'm not going to say that. What I'm saying is, as a world, we've awakened to the fact that we have to clean up our act. And this is through this global perspective of the sounding of the Jubilee trump of knowledge. We're not saying that all laws agree with God's mind. You know, some of the municipalities now are trying to determine about same-sex marriage. And they may very well condone that. But I would say as a general proposition, it is not condoned. Now, we're not saying that our government's going to bring in the kingdom. We're not suggesting that at all. We're suggesting that there's a wake-up. We're suggesting that since October 1874, the Lord has exposed to mankind the evil consequences of his misbehavior. Mankind has responded to this enlightenment by adopting cultural reforms on almost every subject. We find the beginning list of that in pages 197 to 200 in volume 2, Cultural Reforms. Through the Jubilee Trump, the Lord has started eliminating mankind's old ways of thinking. Through the Jubilee Trump, God has started to break down man's old ways of thinking and try to bring them back more in harmony with God's thinking. These cultural reforms are the precursor to individual personal restitution that will be done under the operation of the New Law Covenant. Personal individual return to God-likeness is a ransom work. And the ransom work has yet to begin. We leave you with the thoughts of Romans 14, verse 5. One man esteemeth one day above another. Another esteemeth every day alike. Let every man